Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Hi there, I'm Mark Kenny. And for this episode of Democracy Sausage, I wanted to bring you a live discussion I did recently at ANU with the writer Lek Blain about his new quarterly essay, Bad Cop, Peter Dutton's Strongman Politics. Welcome to tonight's event with Lek Blain on his quarterly essay, Bad Cop, Peter Dutton's Strongman Politics. I'm Mark Kenny, Director of the Australian Studies Institute here at ANU and host of the podcast Democracy Sausage. And I just should let you know that there's a reasonably good chance that this recording that we're doing here of this event tonight will appear as a Democracy Sausage episode in the near future. Can I start first by acknowledging the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet and pay our respects to the elders, Ngunnawal and Ngambri people. I'd also like to thank Anna Lenski and Black Ink for facilitating this event, and there are a few to come. So, Lek Blain, it's a pleasure to have you here at the ANU and to discuss your compelling essay portrait of the man who would be Prime Minister, Peter Dutton. There's a couple of pithy quotes right at the start, which I haven't given you any warning about this, but a couple of pithy quotes right at the start of the essay. They're not actually part of the essay. They're on the facing page, both interestingly from TV shows. One of them is, "The thing about the old days, they the old days." Why did you choose this particular quote? It's from The Wire. Is it Avon Barksdale who says that?
No, it wasn't Barksdale, but yeah, it was one of his crew. And then there's also a True Detective quote.
Yes, I saw that.
So I was thinking about the popular tropes when it comes to police officers, and I was thinking about Peter Dutton, obviously, and there was a few other epigraphs which were a bit more literary, but for some reason I just thought that the two quotes kind of spoke to each other. They kind of contradicted each other, but I just thought that it was...
No, I liked
something
it.
Different.
I liked it, but I thought it might have been. I mean, I don't know how many Wire devotees there are in the crowd, but I can see a couple of people nodding. I actually liked it. I thought it was Avon Barksdale, and I thought, you know, there's a bit of Dutton about him.
Yeah.
You know, sort of tall figure with sort of cold eyes and a kind of a preternatural calm about him a lot of the time.
I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, now that you mention it. Yeah.
And perhaps a little bit of facial Botox as well, but I'm not sure. That's I'm not saying that's a fact, just a suspicion. So in the opening pages, Lek, you sketch out Peter Dutton, ex-cop, university dropout, self-made property investor who before Parliament saw the worst of humanity. Can you talk to us a little bit about, I guess, the importance of that background, how it shapes him, but also, I mean, he's even used the term at one point later in the essay, it scarred him. Mm. His seeing some, you know, fairly tragic events, I suppose, and dealing with people who are on the other side of the law.
Yeah, it was a very, he's spoken more openly recently about his trauma and kind of suggested that he might suffer from undiagnosed PTSD. And some of the cases that he was dealing with involved the really severe sexual assault of children and also domestic violence and murder. So it is, yeah, there's some really horrific experiences. And it happened at quite a young age. So he did drop out of university while running for state parliament at the age of 19, then joined the police academy. So he went from having a very sheltered suburban upbringing in North Brisbane, you know, especially at that time, not a particularly ethnically diverse place in the world, and then kind of went into regional Indigenous communities in the early 90s at a time when the Queensland Police Force had a real siege mentality, both about the Fitzgerald Inquiry, which had exposed corruption within the Queensland Police Force, and then also the Royal Commission into Indigenous Deaths in Custody. So on a few fronts, Queensland police officers felt like they were under siege from elites who were trying to preach to them about things that they didn't understand, or at least that's probably how they saw it, and someone like Dutton would have seen it.
Yes. Can I take you back to a form of words you just used then, because I think they're worth dwelling on. He dropped out of university while he was running for parliament at the age of 19. That's pretty bizarre.
It's quite bizarre, and it's bizarre because by his own admission and by, you know, talking to people who went to school with him, he was a very shy teenager, wasn't a high achiever either in sport or academics. He said himself that he was always more interested in making money than studying, which partly explains his struggling at university in his first year. And so it's quite an odd combination to be both someone who isn't really particularly outgoing, doesn't like the limelight, isn't that academically inclined, and then also running for state parliament at the age of 19. Like, even by the standards of some really ambitious politicians, that's a quite odd thing to do. And it also happened before he joined the police force. So that siege mentality that was very specific to being a Queensland police officer, his political ambitions pre-existed that. And his ideological identification with the Liberal Party pre-existed that. So those experiences might have entrenched his conservatism, but he had like a very sincere identification with the Liberal Party as a teenager.
Yes, and it's interesting that sort of switch from being at university to going to the police force, particularly. I mean, I think that's a perfectly reasonable and honourable thing for people to do, but I think in the context of what we know and what you just observed about him, his consciousness about elites, probably one could conjecture that even at university he's feeling that. He's not enjoying university in the way that you're meant to. He's not shining there. And he's looking for a way out, and his way out is to go into the police force. And then we see that a kind of theme that is quite consistent now very much defines him, this us and them attitude about elites who are trying to tell us what to do.
Yeah, and so this is sort of beginning of the year of where there's a heightened awareness and conversation around political correctness, which a lot of the time was a euphemism for the promotion of Indigenous land rights and a growing conversation around historical ills committed against Aboriginal people. And that led to the phenomenon of Pauline Hanson. And Pauline Hanson was, you know, talked a lot about, well, she was eventually disendorsed based on conversations around the amount of Aboriginal blood within people, welfare recipients. But the start of that letter and the main point that she was making in that letter, which was sent to the Queensland Times at the start of 1996, was about the Royal Commission into Indigenous Deaths in Custody and the fact that Keating had made the Redfern speech, which mentioned that, cited that as a reason for the need for reconciliation, for the need for politicians to promote reconciliation. And then Hanson tapped into this rich vein of resentment, you know, which led to the massive defeat that Keating suffered at the 1996 election. But Dutton was in the background of all of that, and he was seeing these cases where he was extremely angry about the light punishments given to people who'd committed horrific crimes against children, and then ended up leaving the police force after a car accident. So he kind of had a few different reasons to a source of grievance and a source of alienation. And I think that he later expressed kind of pretty open sympathy for what Pauline Hanson was appealing to. So I don't think that the link between those two is me overreading it too much. I think that there is a connection there.
Well, indeed, the success of Hanson in Oxley in 1996, at the time or leading up to then, had been the safest Labor seat in the country, and yet it had suffered as a result of the recession and globalisation and the whole political messaging about the big picture and so forth that had created a sense of dislocation with working people in that area around Ipswich and so forth. We can actually see a link between that phenomenon, that actuality when it happened in 96, which surprised the entire political community, really, a House of Representatives seat falling like that to an independent. I mean, admittedly, She had been an endorsed Liberal candidate. But so I don't think it's too much of a stretch really at all to see that that's quite a formative thing, and we've seen that process happen in the US and the UK and other places as well, that sort of shift of working class traditional Labor voters across to the right.
Yeah, and I would just mention as well, just as a historical coincidence, my my Uncle George, who was my dad's older brother, and dad came from a big working class family in Ipswich that worked on the railways, most of them, and then suffered at the hands of deindustrialization. And George actually went from leaving school at the end of grade 7 to starting a house painting business and ended up having 60 employees. So he was kind of like a proto Howard Butler. Even though he had a tattoo on his arm and he'd played rugby league and he drank and smoked and did all that, he was actually quite conservative economically because he was an employer. He wasn't an employee anymore. He actually ran for the Liberal Party in the seat of Oxley at the 1993 election and then got knocked off for the pre-selection before 1996 by Pauline Hanson. So, yeah, my family is partly responsible for the Pauline Hanson as a political phenomenon, so I apologise to everyone.
Well, we'll decide on the punishment later. Let's go back to Dutton himself, though. I'm interested in the way you characterise him in a number of different points in the essay, which I find I think is an absolutely compelling essay, extremely readable too, really worthwhile. One of the things I noticed that I was quite interested in was that you sort of differentiated him from a number of other recent liberal leaders who I think you describe them as happy-go-lucky at some level. And then you use the term Dutton views the world with the pessimism of a Russian novelist. Talk to me about that.
Well, yeah, and I made those – it's always interesting to compare recent leaders and leaders who – like Dutton, for example, and Howard, who's someone that he really admires and sort of studied under the wing of, but then also to compare him to Morrison and Abbott, and you know, Abbott and him have like a long history together and a lot of affection for each other, but there's kind of differences in their conservatism and the source of that conservatism. There's a difference in their temperament. There's a difference in where they came from and the way that they sort of see the world. And so I think for Dutton, there is kind of like a pessimism to his conservatism that we definitely didn't get a hint of from Morrison. That Morrison was like apocalyptically optimistic. It was she'll be right, mate, was kind of like the vibe that you got from Morrison constantly. And he was like, it became, after people saw it happen too many times, especially in situations of extreme tragedy, like it really did wear really thin. So some of those comparisons I'm not making in a negative sense. I think that there is also the fact that Dutton isn't, I don't think he's, like Abbott was quite a romantic figure. I think Abbott was kind of caught up in this sense of history and like religion and the monarchy. Like Dutton's like very kind of, whether you love him or loathe him, he's very much like focused on the practical realities and practical political opportunities and issues that do animate people. Whereas I think that Abbott, people sensed a kind of like weird fixations emanating from him. And you might argue that Dutton has some strong fixations, but they're fixations that have a history of being politically fertile for conservative politics, whereas for Abbott, some of that stuff seemed out of check with, say, yeah, typical Howard Butlers, like they weren't on the same planet as Abbott.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting observation. I was fairly close in terms of proximity, I should say, to the Abbott prime ministership and to a number of the others. I think it's a good characterisation of Abbott. He had certain, you know, political toughness. He had what you would say was, a coherent conservative ideology or philosophy. But he also had things that he was weirdly committed to and which he was prepared, in a sense, to go over the cliff for, as we saw with knighting of Prince Philip or sticking with Bronwyn Bishop right through a whole period where it was a completely untenable proposition. As I said at the time, and we'll say here again, the worst speaker we've ever seen. And Abbott just stuck there, you know. And Dutton doesn't seem to exude that kind of almost eccentricity. He's tough and he's playing the margins on issues, but a case can be made that they're all about winning, about dividing and parcelling up the electorate and clawing his way to victory.
Yeah, and the argument can be made that the effectiveness of focusing on some of those issues aren't as strong as what they might have been in 2001 or 2004, but he's, yeah, it's like it's very much based on reality. Like even a Labor politician that I spoke to said that, for example, Abbott was incredibly eccentric. Morrison was unhealthily self-obsessed. So even people that didn't like Dutton's politics that I spoke to and rivals within the Liberal Party or even like Labor Party people would say that Dutton's not like vain. He's not someone who's...
Yeah, you say he's not narcissistic.
No, he's not like in politics because he loves the sound of his own voice and he likes seeing his image on the news. And there's a fair few prime ministers and potential prime ministers who you would say that...
Well, all of them are.
So there's, as I said, you can disagree and critique, and I've critiqued in the essay a lot of things, but I think that there is like a kind of genuine conviction there, like set of political convictions there, and that it's not quite the same level of self-obsession that we've seen certainly in someone like Morrison.
Yeah. Now, let's go back, because you do this in the essay, and I think it's worth at least dwelling for a few moments on this, to Dutton's family wellsprings, because there's some interesting forward echoes, or whatever the right term is, of the Dutton that we now see. You know, he's got a great-great-grandfather, I think, who's the, might be great-great-great, I can't remember. There's a lot of greats there anyway, who's the sergeant at arms in the very first...
Yeah, the great-great-great, yeah, and the owner of the first dwelling built in Brisbane and was on the initial Chamber of Commerce and stuff. Yeah. So.
And he testifies to some absolutely appalling massacres of Aboriginal people, deliberate shootings, poisonings using strychnine and arsenic flour, openly testifies about this. And then later on, there's another Dutton who is a member of Parliament.
Yeah, the son-in-law of the great-great-great-grandfather. And then Charles Dutton, which is a great-great-grandfather, he was like a whistleblower about the actions of the native police. So he was writing letters to the Sydney Morning Herald in, like, I think, 1862 about the treatment of Aboriginal people. And then later, a couple of decades later, ended up in the Queensland Parliament as a Minister for Lands. And there's a suburb in Brisbane, Dutton Park, which was named after him. But the family, which at that point had owned considerable land in Queensland, lost a lot of their wealth in really catastrophic drought in 1902. So Dutton's family kind of went from that squatocracy to being working class to lower middle class on the outskirts of Brisbane. And that's the kind of socioeconomic terrain that he was born into. So it sweeps up a lot of the political history of Australia and the development of political parties, for example. This is pre-Labor Party when the working class voted for the Liberals and then there was the more free market people. And so it's
kind of straight. You still see some of those echoes in some of the things that Bob Catter says now.
And it's kind of like it's almost disentangling again. And Catter is I could talk all night about Catter, but I interviewed him and it was really interesting because he encapsulates some of those same changes in the sense that his father was a Maronite Catholic from Lebanon who was a member of the ALP, left during the split with the DLP and then ended up in the Country Party. And that was a quite common sort of shift. And then someone like Dutton, for example, was born into a family where the father was a Catholic bricklayer and the mother was an Anglican secretary. So he was, I'm not sure how much the schisms and the DLP, there's no evidence that they influenced his family, but he was certainly born at a time when there was still that sectarian tension. And he's mentioned there being a little bit of tension in the home because of those religious differences.
Yes, and those, I think we all know those, the sort of religious politics, particularly through the period that he would have been growing up and for some decades before that, they could be quite insidious and quite present in political discussions and considerations. One of the other things that, and I'm conscious that I'm talking to a Queenslander here, but I'm very interested in the extent to which Queensland itself informs Peter Dutton, because we're not used to leaders and prime ministers from Queensland. It's possible that at the next election or the one after that, we could have two Queenslanders if Jim Chalmers is running for Labor. Who knows? I mean, that's, you know, it's at least a possibility. But I admired that great line of Barry Humphreys as Dame Edna Everidge when he said, Australia is the Brisbane of the world.
I wish I'd written that.
It is so good. And on the other side of that, though, is this sort of chip on the shoulder of Queensland about the rest of Australia, about, in a sense, being like a suburb to the rest of Australia.
Yeah, I think Queensland, and it's very historical, like Queensland was the ugly cousin of the Federation. Like Queensland didn't really want to be part of the Federation, and some of the other states definitely didn't want Queensland to be part of the Federation because of...
I'm still undecided myself.
Yeah. Famous last words. But... And that has, you know, so there's that, and that goes to some of the treatment of Aboriginal people, which was being criticised within the southern states. And so this is wrapped up in race as well, where the southern states were criticising the treatment of Aboriginal people in Queensland because colonisation was happening later there. And it's remarkable how similar the language was around the elites and the bleeding hearts. And it was like, it hasn't changed all that much. It's just different issues where you express this sense that people are trying to tell Queenslanders what to do and they're not going to let it happen. And so that then leads throughout to the current moment where for a while now, the zeitgeist has been, well, the Labor Party can't win government back without gaining seats in Queensland. And because they've done so poorly, like Hawke did very well in Queensland. Rudd had a really good result in Queensland in 2007, and he even won in seats in central Queensland that have never gone. Like, I think Dawson hadn't been in Labor for ages, and it hasn't been anywhere even close since.
13% swing in Dawson at that time. Yes.
Yeah. So and a seat like a coal mining seat at an election where Rudd was offering to make an apology and to also institute a CPRS. And that, you know, Howard was as well. So it kind of took the heat out of climate change a little bit, but it's still remarkable. And then it's just, yeah, like the 2019 election was a famous one where Queensland essentially blocked Labor from being able to win government. But then you've got this reverse phenomenon now where the immense success of the coalition in Queensland has started to become a negative for them in some ways because they've become associated so closely with the political culture of Queensland and the political personalities of Queensland that it's actually having a negative effect in the Sydney and Melbourne metropolitan sort of seats. And I think we saw, you know, there was other issues feeding into it, but we saw evidence of that with the Teal phenomenon. And so, yeah, it can be in terms of how Dutton fits into that. Like Dutton's fascinating because he's certainly a creation of Queensland. He certainly has that chip on his shoulder, but he's also doesn't present himself in the same way as what some of those other Queensland populists did. He's not like a Bob Catter or a Clive Palmer or a Pauline Hanson. He's not silly or kind of colourful. Like he could be a police officer from any state. If you didn't know that he was from Queensland, he doesn't sound or look colourful or gregarious. So it's interesting. Yeah, he's a creation of Queensland and he fits in that, but he's not even like quite conservative voters that I speak to in Queensland. Some of them are still pining for Morrison. And a lot of them align with Dutton on a lot of issues. And like I make the point in the essay that I don't think that Dutton is as unpopular with the public. He's not beloved, but he's not as unpopular with the public as some progressive people think. But then there's like quite a lot of conservative people who seem they're not like in love with him. They're sort of, waiting to see, which is, kind of like even amongst Queenslanders that I spoke to was pretty surprising that people who would be heavily in support of a lot of his policy positions didn't seem to really have like an emotional attachment to him.
Time for a short break.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting in Queensland because they're at a sort of a high watermark electorally. There's not really a lot of, they would probably eye getting back some of these seats like Ryan, Brisbane, for example, that they lost to the Greens for Labor, it seems like, what have they got, 5 out of 29 seats or something? It's extremely poor performance. I mean, Labor was saved in the last election in WA of all places. It was quite a surprise as well. But yeah, Queensland's interesting in the sense that it's kind of locked in the coalition at the moment, and we'll see whether it actually has any impact on the result. But it does bring us to Dutton's, I suppose we'll call it, suburban strategy, which is this recognition that there's something going on in the base of the Liberal Party or in the Liberal Party's constituency, and he's very keen to kind of accelerate that. I mean, we've seen this for decades, right? I mean, they used to talk about Reagan Democrats, and we saw the shift of traditional working-class Labor voters over Brexit in the north of England, and we know about, you know, the sort of white Christian vote that is behind Donald Trump that are mostly ex-working class, unionised, you know, habitual Democrat voters who have seen an identity shift and now identify themselves as I say, white Christian or whatever it is. Dutton seems to be picking up on all of these examples and looking at where he can make gains. And that's why at his very first press conference as leader, he was asked what he was going to do to get back the seats that had been lost to the Teals. I mean, it was, you know, we might be a bit used to it, but it was an astonishing election really for what happened with, you know, six of their most pressured electoral jewels shifting into those independents' hands. And I think probably reasonably firmly into those hands. We'll see what some redistributions and things do. But Dutton's got this strategy of effectively flipping disenfranchised working class Labor voters in the suburbs. You mentioned before there are some inconsistencies there, like as in there are differences between the polity and the electorate from the one that Howard had to deal with, both in terms of feminisation of the workforce and in terms of multicultural influences and so forth. So are the maths going to allow him to get anywhere with this strategy?
It's kind of pretty... You know, you don't see much ambition in Australian politics, and this isn't about policy, but in terms of like the actual strategy, it's like pretty ambitious. But it also, I think it's incredibly hard to see him winning a majority at the next election. So he denies that there's a two-term strategy, but it seems like that's the best explanation for what is going on, because most Liberals, even if they acknowledge that there is vulnerabilities for Labor in the outer suburbs, they still believe that they need to win back inner metropolitan seats as well to be able to form a majority. So there's the idea that there's a hypothesis that what he's trying to do is drive Labor into minority government at the next election, win enough seats that he can preserve his leadership and that he'll overperform and they'll give him another chance, and then he can try to hammer Labor like Abbott did with the Gillard minority government and go back after some of those, you know, even the Bennelongs and Higgins, so that it will lost to Labor on economic grounds if Labor's forced into doing some more addressing progressive economic issues by the Greens or by some of the Teals. So in terms of the, like there are real vulnerabilities for Labor in the outer suburbs, and I think there is disillusionment there amongst people who are really loyal Labor voters, but they feel like they've been taken for granted. And we saw a manifestation of that with Dai Li at the last election. And I think that there will be more of those style independents, and they're sort of in the works.
Yeah, so that's in Fowler in Western Sydney.
Yeah, in Fowler. I think the mayor in Fairfield is probably a strong possibility of running in one of those adjoining seats at the next election. But whether Dutton, like the Liberal Party, have kind of slept on these seats, because a lot of them are quite multicultural, but they're not socially progressive. They can be socially conservative. They can be quite economically progressive. Like, they want more housing. They want better services. They want government investment. And the Liberal Party have just been asleep. Well, they've been asleep on gender, but they've been asleep on multiculturalism for yonks. And it's not just a conservatism thing, because you look at the British Conservative Party and you can say, well, it might not have, they're not doing great at the moment, but they're actually a lot more ethnically diverse than the Australian Liberal Party. I think the Republicans might be more ethnically diverse than the Australian Liberal Party. So yeah, it's interesting. Like, there would be opportunities there, but the other thing is that the margins in some of these seats are incredibly high for Labor. And if you look at some of those notorious Howard Battler seats, the only one that's sort of still in their grasp is Lindsay. And that's the one that Tony Abbott says, that's the Liberal Party. Forget about Warringah. Our new heartland is Lindsay, which is based around the area of Penrith. And the Liberal Party lost the state seat of Penrith at the last state election in New South Wales. So the idea that that's like their new heartland and that's their new Warringah and Wentworth seems like it's driven more by someone like Abbott's emotional desire to never have to deal with moderate Liberals again because they brought down his prime ministership. So I don't know whether Dutton's fully on that. I think Dutton's too pragmatic to be like that he doesn't want to win those Till seats back. I think that he's not going to define his policy offering by trying to placate.
It strikes me that he doesn't want to mix his message. I mean, he feels unburdened by not having to really sort of message to those inner urban elites, as he would describe them, and he can have a much clearer message about cost of living and about energy and these sorts of things, you know, uncluttered by all those other sort of sensitivities. But as you say, that comes with some other complications because if we see some of his cumbersome messaging around events recently in Sydney, you know, the whole rise of the spectre of terrorism, we see it around the arrival of boats and the High Court decisions and the like, there are people who feel who are quite socially conservative, who voted in large numbers against same-sex marriage, who voted in large numbers against, in these Labor seats, against The Voice, for example. But they are not hearing a message of affection from Peter Dutton on these other questions around multiculturalism.
Yeah, around multiculturalism or on those bread and butter issues that they care about. And I think that that's where Labor will focus very clearly on Dutton's experience as a health minister before the next election. I think that that's where they, with voters who might be sympathetic towards some of Dutton's social views, if they can get the argument back onto health and onto the cost of living and then the economy starts to improve, that can take some of the wind out of the sails that Dutton had, say, during the Voice campaign, where, you know, his confidence visibly improved. Like, he was on a roll, and then at the end of last year he thrives arguing about these really black and white issues because he describes himself as a black and white person, where they're not really complex policy debates. He can just tap into pre-existing discourse and cliches and arguments, and it's about elites and all that sort of thing. But then when you actually have quite complex policy debates, like, say, around inflation or tax reform or what we're seeing at the moment with nuclear, I don't think Dutton really has a wealth of experience prosecuting really complex policy debates with the Australian public. And that's certainly something that you wouldn't say about Howard, or you wouldn't say about Costello. You might not have loved Howard, but he had both a skill but also a willingness to front up and have debates with sometimes hostile interviewers. And, you know, he was hostile towards, say, the ABC, but he was still able to engage with them and leave people with the impression that he knew what he was talking about on, like, a really deep level.
Yes, it's going to be fascinating to see how he does some of that messaging, because at the moment it is, as you say, quite black and white. Do you think he's made the transition from the preoccupation that all opposition leaders have, and none more so than when their party has just surrendered government and they've gone freshly into opposition? Has he made the transition from being inwardly focused, that is, you know, worrying about his own job security, to the broader messaging he needs to do to the electorate, because he's quite clearly secure in his job between now and the election?
Yeah, I think that that's the other thing. There's no obvious alternative. If you look at the next rung below him in terms of the most senior people that have been maybe positioning to take that next step, it's like Susan Ley, Angus Taylor, Dan Tehan would be maybe another one. Like, I don't know whether there's...
I'm sensing a huge amount of enthusiasm in the room.
Not a sense of a huge amount of hunger within the audience for Angus Taylor based on that response. But, so this is something when you talk to people who work in Parliament and they say, you know, even like Labor people, you get the sense from a lot of even that second rung Liberal people that they don't really know what's going on in Parliament. Like, but Dutton is someone that actually...
He's a very experienced parliamentarian.
Yeah.
And they both are actually Albanese.
Yeah. And he understands the debate, and he might not be as much of a wonk on procedure as like Albanese and Burke are, but he sort of gets the gist of it, and he has instincts around what works, but he doesn't have a huge amount of support. And I think that the other thing in terms of being an opposition leader is traditionally opposition leaders need to disappoint their base. on some kind of like...
Yeah, that's where I was going, really.
Yeah, like
you look at a thing like nuclear, and this is clearly red meat to the base, right? This is saying we're not going to go down this path, this sort of woke path of embracing renewables and having wind farms and, you know, your agricultural land torn up with transmission lines and everything else. We've denied this for the last dozen years. Here's our answer, and that's nuclear, you know, 20 years down the track and $50 billion later.
Yes, you might say that Abbott didn't really disappoint his base, like, but he was up against a party and a government that was kind of tearing itself apart, and that there were some really big, significant policy issues that weren't working well for Labor within the general public. So, but I think when you're generally speaking an opposition leader, you kind of need to, yeah, you need to disappoint your base on a few big issues so that people who didn't vote for you at the last election get a sense that you're, it's almost like a symbolic thing, even more than a policy thing. It's like showing that you're ready to make sacrifices to win the people who didn't vote for you, and that you're like a serious politician, that you're ready to be a prime minister. Like Rudd, for example, as an opposition leader, like used to give progressives and Labor loyalists the shits because of how willing he was to disappoint them. But it also created that appetite for the sense that he was ready to replace someone who, in Howard, who at times wasn't the most popular person in the world, but he was respected by the electorate at large, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? One thinks of Kevin Rudd back in that 2007 election, the ad that you can probably all remember, where he describes himself as an economic conservative or fiscal conservative, and a title that he carries with pride. And that was that kind of thing, wasn't it? It was about reaching across and trying to get those people who had...
Yeah, and he was also criticising Howard and Costello for their profligate spending.
Yeah, this reckless spending. Yeah. Stop it, once. Yes, there was a bit of chutzpah there. But we see what you're saying with Keir Starmer in the UK. There's a lot of friction from the Labour faithful about how unbold he is looking and how procedural and so forth. But it is about reassuring the electorate after a very tumultuous time. Dutton doesn't seem to me to be someone whose strength is in reassuring people. I don't mean that as a criticism necessarily, but I think, for example, we think about The Voice, what he's very good at doing. He did very effectively in The Voice, it seemed to me, with the complicit support of a lot of media, is that he took a very divisive stance and packaged it as a unifying stance, and everyone just seemed to buy it.
And he had really short, blunt messages, and he just repeated them over and over and over again, which is actually kind of like they would both hate being compared with each other, but Rudd was willing to kind of just repeat the same message over and over and over again, and Dutton doesn't have any shame about that. That's probably something that Turnbull wasn't particularly good at, because he would find that kind of demeaning the intelligence of the Australian people by just dumbing it down and repeating it. But Dutton does that. It just keeps on hammering over and over. And if he's like hitting the mark in some way with the Australian people, then that can be really effective. But he, as I said earlier, like he hasn't shown much knack in terms of complex policy debate. There's not a great amount of warmth emanating from him. There's not really a...
No, it's not. There's not something that you normally hear mentioned in relation to him as warmth.
Or humour. And there's some like famous examples of him where he, in Parliament, where he's tried to be the kind of Keating zinger guy, and it just fell really flat. He was telling these stories about comparing Bill Shorten to being a bikey boss, and it was Bill the bikey, and so it was just bizarre. And even Barnaby Joyce was sitting in the background just with a really perplexed look on his face. And so that means that he's kind of like fairly one-dimensional, but that doesn't mean that he's completely ineffective or that Labor can afford to underestimate him.
Yeah, it's a good point. What do you think of his political judgment? I mean, he's obviously got these very strong conservative tropes that he's sticking with, as you say, the sort of lines that he's putting out, and people know pretty much where he stands. But he's had some pretty fallible political judgments recently as well. The coalition's response to the Stage 3 tax cuts change was pretty tin-eared, it seemed to me. And I got to say, again, a lot of the media were just caught up in this whole notion about the broken promise, as distinct from the fact that the rejigging of Stage 3 resulted in, what was it, 84% of people getting more and no one going backwards, everyone getting a tax cut. and the top end getting still much more than everyone else. It's just they weren't getting double what they ended up with. And no one really talks about the broken promise anymore. But, it, you know, as you say, Susan Lee came out and said they were going to roll it back. We've seen this fallible judgment come out from them a few times. Do you think it's going to be a problem for them, or is that something that he's going to have to get better at?
Well, as I said, he doesn't have much support. He's a fairly, like, he's a one-dimensional character. So he's kind of relying on economic conditions to remain pretty weak and for Labor to start to get really nervous and begin capitulating. But, yeah, I think that in terms of the where do they go in different policy issues, in terms of, like, say, property and housing, like this, it's reaching a point where these issues are kind of, it's not just the inner city woke elites who are worried about, like, it transcends the culture wars. It's like people who live in the outer suburbs, working class people, people who are socially conservative are worried about whether they're ever going to be able to buy a house and being able to afford their rent and the way that that's affecting the next generation after them. So the culture wars can be effective in certain situations, but I think that there is, even amongst disengaged voters, there is like a real appetite for actually addressing some of the issues which are defining modern Australian life and which is dividing modern Australia from the kind of lives that, you know, my parents were able to enjoy a level of social mobility, going from being working class to being able to afford to own their own home, that I don't think that exists anymore in the same way. I don't think people like my parents who didn't finish high school would be able to start a business and buy a house and to allow their children to have a totally different style lifestyle, because especially if they live in the city, I don't see how they would ever be able to buy a place. It's pretty bleak, and there is a kind of really deep disillusionment out there, and you know that it's going to affect the whole political system. But Dutton is really good at stoking the disillusionment, but at some point there also needs to be something to cure the disillusionment, and I haven't seen much evidence of that yet.
On the other side, of course, he's been described as someone who's been underestimated all his life. Anthony Albanese has described himself as someone who's been underestimated all his life. They're both in leadership positions in their parties, Albanese being the Prime Minister. Abbott was said to be unelectable. We talked about a lot of volatility, the sort of circumstances you're just talking about in the electorate, disaffection and dislocation within the electorate. If we look at what small electoral indicators we do have, empirical ones, you know, actual people voting, we think about The Voice, for example. What was it? I think 20 of Labor's seats recorded better than 50% vote, so effectively voted yes. That's a lot of people listening to or either not convinced by the yes campaign or persuaded away from it by the no campaign at some point, which Dutton was prominent in. I think back to Warringah in 2017. But I think I wrote this at the time, but Abbott's electorate of Warringah, you know, the one that he now thinks they shouldn't worry about anymore, that, of course, became the first Teal electorate, the very first one in their 2019 election. And it had voted, Warringah had voted, I think it was about 64% in favour of same-sex marriage in that postal survey, which, by the way, was Dutton's idea, I think, wasn't it, the postal survey, to get them out of a problem. But and there was Abbott, the local member for Warringah, who was essentially the number one champion of opposed to same-sex marriage. And so there was an early indicator that the electors of that North Shore seat were leaving their member. Now, perhaps there's a lot of evidence there now that Labor's in a lot more trouble in some of these electorates on some of these social policy questions than has been appreciated, and that Dutton has this ability to speak to this disaffection.
I think that there is a legitimate, and this is like a long-term trend in terms of the level of university education and the way that seats that have a lower level of university education are becoming more conservatives, whereas traditionally it was the other way around. More people who were university educated voted Liberal, and they were the party of like lawyers and doctors, and we are seeing evidence of that shifting, and we've got doctors winning seats for the Labor Party in a seat like Higgins, which was a, you know, jewel in the Liberal crown and
Seat
of Costello. So there is evidence of it. It's just whether those trends are accelerating enough to deliver the prime ministership to Dutton in, say, at the next election or the election after that. Like, these are, they're long-term trends, and that's why it's an uphill battle. He's not completely imagining those trends, but it's kind of like a race against time, and he's an extremely ambitious, ruthless person, so he's going to pursue it with as much gusto as possible, but it's going to be, yeah, very challenging.
In the essay, you cite a number of different times where Dutton does visits to businesses, which is very standard behaviour for political leaders, and then they do a doorstop press conference and accentuate the issues that have been raised there. Usually there are some grabs from the, you know, the business owner about how tough conditions are or whatever it is. I noticed that, I can't say this is exhaustive, but I can think of three occasions in the essay where you refer to this, and they're all Italian business owners. And it made me think, well, that's interesting in itself, although possibly just a coincidence, but it made me think it's pretty unlikely that he would have been at a Muslim business, a Muslim-owned business. And that speaks, I think, to difficulties that he has with a significant part of the electorate. And he's not endearing himself to that part of the electorate with some of his behaviour, either in respect of the Israel-Gaza conflict or the recent events we've seen here.
Which would be communities that would be receptive to social conservatism and also small business aspirationalism, and yet the Liberal Party just can't take a trick, or maybe they're starting to wake up to it, but then they're still going backwards in a number of different ways in terms of their diversity, in terms of gender representation. So, but in terms of his visits, like, what one of the fascinating things is that where Dutton makes these appearances and talks quite openly about the coalition being the parties of the working class, I can't remember Labor politicians, like, because Labor politicians are terrified about speaking about class. That's why we hear about working families and, yeah, euphemisms like that. Like, it's very rare to hear Labor politicians speak openly about class anymore. And then you've actually got quite a few coalition MPs, including your Matt Canavans, where they're like, yeah, we're the working class party and we're like sticking up for working class people. And that might seem like a very opportunistic, cynical, insincere thing to do, but it's interesting the way that the parties are kind of adopting the opposite historical traditions of either side in terms of who they associate themselves with.
Yeah, it's an absolutely fascinating shift, as you say, both in language and in the way those electorates are tending to tumble at elections. So it's going to be quite fascinating. That concludes the proceedings tonight. So I think Lex is going to do some signing.
Yeah, thanks everyone for coming out. An awesome crowd, and thanks for having me. That was an amazing conversation. It's amazing when you see your own thoughts more clearly by having a conversation. So, yeah, and thanks for having me at the university, and I really appreciate everyone coming out. So thank you very much.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.